You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Welcome to the center, to old friends and new. Thank you very much for making it on what is, of course, a very auspicious time. As we speak, His Highness Sheikh Tamim is speaking right now on the television to his people. So, and let us congratulate him upon assuming his position, and let us also congratulate his Highness Sheikh Hamad bin Khalifa for his rule over the country over the last 18 years and his involvement with Qatar for so many more. I want to go straight into the event, just because I think you'll agree it's something extremely interesting, where we're going to focus on the challenge of minority rights in a changing Arab world. Somebody said to me earlier that it's a little bit edgy. Well, yes, we want it to be a full and open discussion about this particular subject. I'm very pleased to have with us today three very esteemed academics, scholars, experts, in this area with a wealth of experience in this and other areas. Let me first, just going down the line, introduce to you Dr. Lina Beydoun. She's, I'm very happy and proud to say, a Brookings Doha Center Qatar University Joint Fellow. Since 2008, she's been an assistant professor in the sociology department at Adelphi University. Previously, you taught at George Mason University, where you managed the Global Humanitarian Action and International Development Program in the Center for Global Education. You've also worked in a number of other areas and universities. Your work and publications have focused on human rights, migration, and citizenship in the Arab region and sub-Saharan Africa. It's a real pleasure to have you here, Lina. I know you're going to start off, but before you do, I'll just keep going through. Dr. Khaled Roub, who first and foremost is a dear friend. It's a pleasure to have you here. You, of course, you're a professor in residence of the Faculty of Liberal Arts at Northwestern University here in Doha. You're focused on Middle Eastern studies and Arab media studies. You're also a senior research fellow at the Center of Islamic Studies at the Faculty of Asian and Middle Eastern Studies, University of Cambridge, where you are the director of the Cambridge Arab Media Project. You've authored some amazing books, I would say, including Hamas, A Beginner's Guide, Hamas, Political Thought and Practice, and the edited Political Islam, Context versus Ideology, and in Arabic, including The Fragility of Ideology and the Might of Politics in 2010. Currently, you're writing a book on the critique of the Arab Renaissance Project. Again, Khaled, it's wonderful to have you here. And certainly not least, Dr. Falah Al-Jabbar, the director of the Iraq Institute for Strategic Studies in Beirut. You're a research fellow also at Birkbeck College in the University of London. Your works include Tribes and Power in the Middle East, and the Shia movements of Iraq, Ethnicity and State, the Case of the Kurds. I know you've just arrived a short time ago. It's a real pleasure to have you here, Dr. Jabbar. Before I start, just a couple of quick rules. If you could turn your phones onto silent. I'll also point out, as has been the case in our recent, workshops and seminars, we've got live coverage from Al Jazeera Mubashir. So it's a pleasure to have our audience back at home watching this as well. And also, we will be active on social media, on Twitter and the like. And this particular discussion will be webcasted on our Brookings homepage as well. So there's no escaping from what you say. Without further ado, Lina, if I could, how we're going to do it today is we'll have interventions from each of the three guests, and then we will get into a question and answer session, and then we will open it up, of course, to you. We have plenty of time. We have about an hour and a half. So, Lina, please.
First off, I want to start by speaking about minorities in general. What are minorities? The definition of minorities could be very expansive and it could be very narrow. Some assume that minorities have to do with size only and with numbers. So if you're small in a nation state, then you're considered a minority. The more broad definition of minority is one that is denied most of its rights or some of its rights. It faces some kind of discrimination. It could face persecution in a specific society at a specific time. And this group will adhere to this particular definition. And we will also focus on religious minorities and some ethnic minorities in the Arab region that will be the focus of discussion. Myself, I will be focusing mostly on minorities in Egypt, and I will be focusing in general on the Egypt case study. And so I will be focusing on three religious minorities, the Coptic Christian minority, the Shia minority, and the Baha'i minority. Our argument here in this panel is that the lack of protection of minorities and the lack of minority rights started with the construction of the modern nation state. We think that there is a failure in nation building, specifically in the Arab region, and that has led to the lack of inclusiveness of so-called minority groups in many different countries, especially countries that have a broad kind of heterogeneous society that includes both cultural minorities and religious minorities. And I also argue that women are also a minority. Unless there is gender equality in these societies, they could also constitute a minority in themselves. So the big problem is that in the modern nation state, we find that there is a lack of inclusiveness and a lack of constitutional rights in general and a lack of full citizenship rights. And we think that is the main problem and that is the main challenge of minority rights. In the specific case of Egypt, the lack of minority rights, one could argue, goes back to the construction of the nation state under Nasserism, and it started to actually intensify under Sadat and then under Mubarak and continued under the present Morsi administration. And so we will be talking about all these different phases in the construction of the nation state. My general sense is that there was more minority rights, for instance, in Egypt, under the monarchy of King Farouk. And this is something that the people that I spoke to there in Egypt basically come to a consensus to. Now, what has happened? What was the response of some of the minorities toward their exclusion? For instance, the Coptic Christian minority, which is the largest one in Egypt, and it's actually the largest in terms of number in the whole entire Middle East, is that it isolated itself. Everything was focused on the church. All the activities were focused within the church fortress or boundaries. Basically, it didn't allow for the diversity of voices to emerge within the Coptic Christian community. And that in itself has changed, one could argue, after the revolution, when more voices came out into the streets, and the street allowed for the youth, especially the youth Copts, to organize outside this fortress church itself. So this is some these are some of the changes that have happened after the revolution, which allow for more of these minorities, especially the Coptic Christian minority in Egypt, to actually call for more inclusiveness and to demand more of their rights. So this is one of the theses that I will discuss further as we go along. And I wanted to say also one other point, is that church construction was limited since Sadat, so it's not something new. Both church construction and church renovation have been limited. And also the Shia Muslim community and the Baha'i community are not allowed their own open spaces or places of worship since then, too. And I will leave it there and then come back to talk about more specifics about the Egyptian case.
Thank you, Lena. Khaled, please.
Minorities actually has to do with the modern nation state. didn't exist, you know, before that. You know, there were minorities here and there, but the empires of the past were multicultural, multi-religious, multi-everything. Now, the modern state has two sides to it. One is state formation, creating like administration, standing armies, constitution, parliament, yeah, what have you. But on the other hand, you have nation building. And these are two different processes, or they are one and the same process in homogeneous societies. There are two different processes in multicultural and heterogeneous societies. And the problem in the Arab world and even in the Islamic world around us, like Turkey and Iran, is this divorce between or the incongruence between nation building and state formation. And we have been paying that price. Modern nation state, where society was, you know, culturally homogeneous, like one religion, even one sect, nation building went on smoothly. Where it was heterogeneous, it didn't. And many examples, we can cite many examples. The case of Iraq, Syria, Yemen, you name it, around us. Many, many cases. Sudan, southern of Sudan, or the case of the Amazigh in North Africa. And this problem was exacerbated throughout the post-colonial era. We had military rules, military regimes. We had single-party systems who were, by definition, so monopolistic of not only of political power, but also of economic power and hegemony over culture. And when you have a group that has no inclusion, political inclusion, who are deprived economically, who are culturally oppressed or discriminated against, then you have a problem. And if this group is from a religion that's different than that of the ruler, then you have sectarianism. And or from a different sect, you have sectarianism. Or from a different region, you have regionalism. And or from a different tribe, you have tribalism. From a different class, you have class war. It's all there. It's this monopoly, this extreme monopoly of political power wedded with economic power, wedded with cultural, even the language of communication is sometimes monopolized in certain societies. And that's the real problem. It lies therein. We can take, of course, many examples that we can discuss later on from Iraq or elsewhere. But you see, I mean, these three forms that I talked of, four forms that I talked about, regionalism, sectarianism, tribalism, and class deprivation, they all exist, for example, in Yemen. And they all exist in Iraq. We have the ethnic, of course, dimension. If you have an ethnic group that suffers from these three, four forms of exclusion, then you have ethnic war. You have separatist tendencies, and so on and so forth. And these are, by definition, either cultural or social or ethnic or religious or communal minorities. By the definition, because why we say minorities? Because this is a numerical kind of quantitative approach. Because we have borders. We have a group defined within borders. And within these borders, you can count people. And, the idea that, John Locke's treatise, that democracy rests on consent and majority rule, majoritarianism, is by definition quantitative and numerical. And here we are. We have regimes that are dictatorial, or non-democratic, if you like, and we have these problems heaped upon us altogether. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Before I come to Khaled, I just want to come back to Lina for 1 second, and Dr. Jabbar, and then we'll come to Khaled. In Egypt, are the transitions addressing this in terms of minority rights? You're saying that there is, from what I'm hearing from both of you, you're saying that there is a problem. Are they being addressed, or is this a phenomenon which is becoming more acute in terms of the challenge of minority rights?
that was the next step in this discussion. Since you mentioned this, I would argue that it's actually become more intensified at this time instead of being addressed. The concept of inclusiveness was supposedly going to be attempted in the first 100 days of the election of President Morsi, but that, for many complex reasons, had failed. That attempt at inclusiveness of different minorities, for instance, inclusiveness of women and Coptic leaders in the new parliament, within the cabinet, but that failed. And it's very unfortunate because one expected that this transition into democracy to move forward in a very positive way. Instead, it has polarized the country into two bigger groups, one that calls itself non-Islamist. It's based on civil forces, revolutionary forces, who want to continue gaining or demanding their rights. And part of the constituencies of the civil society or non-Islamist movement or civil forces or revolutionary forces would be those that represent the different minorities, who say that they are actually losing more rights for many different reasons that I can go into, including the security vacuum that resulted from the past year of maybe a weak government, a weak centralized government, to the rise of more extremist forms of Islam, or the Salafis, represented by Salafis and other kinds of extremist groups that seem to have had or that space to actually manifest this sort of pure Islamic society in Egypt. We see it, of course, most recently 3 days ago with the killing of a Shia cleric in Abu Musallam village in the governorate of Giza.
Let's stop
there. There's a lot to talk about.
I'm going to come back to you on these things, but I just wanted to get a little bit more of a taster on the Egypt side. I'm going to come to Khaled, but I promise you, in 1 second. But I want to just ask you one more question, Dr. Jabbar, which is about, you talk about nation building. Surely the Middle East has been a wonderful mosaic of nations for centuries. Why is it posing to be such a problem now in the post-Ottoman period?
Well, if I focus on sectarianism, and in specific the Shia-Sunni relations, sects and communities, such sects and communities, existed for about 14th century. Mm. And attempts to politicize the cultural differences, their religious differences, failed in the 40s, 50s, 60s. Politicization was successful in the 70s onwards, and it had a strong encouragement from the Iranian, after the Iranian Revolution and the rise of political Islam. And the question is why it succeeded at this point is a crucial question. Going back to the monarchy, the era of monarchy, the monarchy was Iraq as a nation state was built by the British on the basis of a Sunni-Shi'i alliance understanding. And that was the gist of the very soul of Iraqi patriotism, if you like. With some understanding or an agreement as a side issue with the Kurds. And if you look at the political structure, you'll find or the economic level. First, there was no industry. We had landlordism. And looking at the class of landlords, 48% were Shiites, 20% were Kurds, 20% were Arab Sunnis, 3% were Christians, 2% were this. And there was, economic inclusion and participation was clear to see. And if you look at the parliament and the ministries, the cabinets, you'll see a similar, although not as solid as that one. So, and you have cultural freedom for all sects and groups. There you are. We have a new government after 1968 that monopolized the economy, nationalized everything. It had oil money flowing in. And inclusion was selective. The landlord class was over, a new upper class was created, but was a crony kind of capitalism. It was selective. It was, you know, it was structured by the government, by the central government, to serve its own ends as a control system, as a system of governance, rather than as a tool of nation building. And in that sense, I mean, you have kinship networks, you have party networks, you have all sort of localism, local spirit. And in the end, you have the national wealth, levers of power, economic wealth, cultural freedom, all, you know, concentrated into fewer and fewer hands. And the discourse to challenge this condition was, in the 60s, was that of class. Well, this is a bourgeois monopolistic class. Or that of liberalism. This is a non-democratic, anti-liberal kind of government that hates the vibrant private sector, etc., etc. And we had also another discourse at that time, the sectarian discourse. This happened because we are not Sunnis. This happened because we are not Shiis. This happened because this and that. With the rise of political Islam, there you have it. And now it has become not only a national issue in Iraq or elsewhere, it has become a regional issue. It's a big regional problem now. And I'll talk about that later on.
Yes, and that brings me very well to Khalid. Almost.
Thank you very much. I think I had to kind of discontinue with this very insightful and rich argument to go back to some kind of initial maybe points. And I'll start with the two. One is to do with the terminology and definition, and the second to do with the nation state and nation state building. The quick one is to do with terminology. It's kind of only injecting some sort of caveat. That is, when we talk about minority, then majority on the other side, these are not kind of homogeneous blocks. And if you think of the Shia in Iraq, or say the Christians in Lebanon, or the Copts maybe in Egypt as well, the Amazighi communities in North Africa, these are very diverse. Only the Christians in Lebanon, they could be divided into 12 sects, I guess. So again, this kind of dichotomous maybe approach should be taken with cautious. Otherwise, we perpetuate maybe some sort of, I wouldn't say artificial, but kind of maybe an instrumental way of analyzing things and reflecting this as solid reality. And of course, to avoid imposing this maybe up-down kind of identification or categorization of individuals and people. Maybe we need to, of course, I mean, the lack of rights on the side of these individuals and the groups should be all the time approached. But maybe this is a challenge to all of us, that we need to approach these rights maybe without being hijacked with this terminology, you know, minority versus majority. Now, to go back to the maybe kind of very, I would say, basic point, which is the failure of the nation states in the region, from which we can witness this the resulting of so many failures, including the inclusion of minorities and other groups. I think the whole project of the nation state in the region has been incomplete. And if on the one side, as Faleh has been saying, they succeeded in having state building, the nation building is still something in the process. The state itself, in many cases, used to be the instigator, if you like, the party that would initiate sectarianism. If you think of the case of Syria, where the whole system over maybe four decades or more is built on very narrow sectarian politics. And because of this, and now what we are witnessing nowadays in Syria, one could say and argue this is a result of these four decades of very narrow-minded sectarianism, where the state, the nation, the wealth of the nation, everything was channeled to serve the ruling elite, which comes from a certain sect. Antagonizing, of course, over the time, all other segments of society, including the biggest one. Now, the other point that I really want to kind of focus on, the biggest failure of this nation building comes on the side of constitutional citizenship. Now, because of the lack of this big notion, which is the cornerstone of any nation building in the modern sense of the term, you will end up with the state as the aggressor against the individuals instead of being the protector. So these individuals, with their sub-loyalties, be them to tribal, their tribes, ethnicities, sects, so on and so forth, after maybe 5 or 6 decades after the decolonization, they still feel exposed vis-a-vis the state. So the state never succeeded in transforming itself into a protector of these individuals and transforming them from maybe subjects into citizens and dragging them away from their sub-loyalties. Now they feel their tribes, their sects, their religion, this and that, these are the constructs where they feel protected. So you feel, you witness this kind of back and forth between the loyalty to the state and then the sub-loyalty to these smaller identities. Now, the irony nowadays that one could witness, and this is maybe open to discussion and contemplating, at this very moment, now this state that has been playing two different roles, if you like, the attempt of nation building, and then on the other side, the aggressor against individual rights. In the perception, in the collective Arab perception, this nation state has been, by and large, for maybe a very long period of time, somehow rejected or even seen with deep suspicion. This is the legacy of colonialism. This is the legacy of foreign powers. They came into the region, then they occupied the region for a long period of time, then they after their withdrawal, they left these artificially drawn borders with different nation, small nation states. So the reception of the whole idea of nation state was from the very, very beginning, was not really great. The nation state is seen as a product of colonial power. Now, the irony, the biggest irony nowadays, and this is my point that we need maybe kind of to think of and contemplate, is this seemingly artificial unit that was drawn by foreign powers nowadays could be seen as the only shield, one of the biggest shields against the overflooding of sectarianism. If you think of sectarianism kind of overflooding the Iraqi border into Syria or into Saudi Arabia, or the sectarianism from Syria in spilling over into Lebanon, people now, they are kind of, they defend the borders and they want these borders to stand in the face of this overflooding of sectarianism. Had we not having these kind of artificial borders, one could think of this overflooding of sectarianism going regionally without any obstacles in the way. Because you have Shias in Iraq, you have them in Saudi Arabia, you have them in Syria, you have them in Lebanon. So what kind of barriers, where do you draw the line? These lines are, ironically speaking again, these lines are the colonial lines drawn by foreign powers. Now everybody is kind of trying to stick to them and to protect their kind of, if you like, the so-called national identity or national interest. Maybe I stop here because I feel like...
Thank you. Well, you raised a number of very interesting points, one of which is this idea of constitutional citizenship and the lack of progress in this regard. I want to ask you, now with the Arab awakenings and new states being born from old regimes, isn't there an opportunity, for example, Tunisia may well produce the Arab world's first real modern constitution. Isn't there an opportunity now in which exactly what you're talking about, that work can actually move in a more purposeful fashion, in a more indigenous fashion, which can actually guarantee rights for citizens, including those, of course, of minorities?
Well, my answer to this is yes, with a great deal of caution, because Yes, why is this? Because I think at the end of the day, after 60 or maybe 70 years of freezing natural, social, political, and cultural forces within these societies, everything was somehow stagnated because of the authoritarian nature of the regime, of the regimes, in fact. So everything was there, frozen, nothing, no dynamics, no political dynamics, no social dynamics, no cultural dynamics. And I think in my view, my humble view, this kind of dynamic, the competition, the rivalry maybe, even the antagonistic kind of practices, the politics, all these kind of things, these are the necessary phase, maybe unavoidable phase, especially at the very, very beginning of nation building that we have to go through. Now, this phase was missed out. This was lost. We lost 60 years. And instead of going through this phase, trying to find maybe the balancing point after maybe a long period of time, we lost that. So those were the lost decades. Now we have started the job that we should have started maybe 6 or 7 decades ago. This is why I am saying yes. Yes, what we are seeing in the short term is maybe a very bleak picture. All the decadent, if you like, product of the stagnated phase is now coming in our phase. But be it. Otherwise, we are just kidding ourselves. I mean, I keep kind of differentiating between two things. Stability with authoritarianism, which is very deluding thing, and the stability with the freedom. Well, during Saddam era, we had stability. Under Assad, we had stability. Under Zain al-Abidin bin Ali in Tunis, we had stability as well. But this is very deceiving stability. It is, you keep everything rotten under the carpet. Now the carpet is no longer there. Yes, we are facing so many problems. It's very scary. But let's face it. I mean, we have to go through this so that we can go to the next phase, which is hopefully finding this equilibrium between the different forces in society, and where people finally believe that there is no way but to coexist with each other. Now maybe they think we have to kill each other. Well, then the point will come when everybody thinks and would have even the proof that there is no way out but to exist with each other.
Thank you. Dr. Jabbar, do we have to go through this phase when we look at Iraq? Are we moving through a difficult and bloody phase because we perhaps may arrive at something?
Unfortunately, yes.
A political system, a political balance, a political equilibrium, or even the disillusion of elements of the state in order to arrive at something which can guarantee the rights and help in the prosperity of the citizens of that country.
Look, what the totalitarian regime left us with is a politicized identity politics. Ethnic, that's all, Kurdish, Turkmen. But we have also the politicized Sunni and Shi'i communal identity, highly politicized. You know, Saddam Hussein revived the tribes, and he is secular and modernist, in brackets. He also waged faith campaigns, reviving religion and religious symbols and giving aid to all sorts of clerics and, you know, even allowing, verbal fight between Shi'is and Sunnis under his control. Now, after 2003, these differences were militarized. We shifted from politicization to mass politicization to militarization. Militarization receded, but the roots are there. And why they are there? As I said earlier, the British helped create Iraq as a nation state under the monarchy on the basis of a Shi'i-Sunni alliance that was created by society itself. And the leader of that is Ja'far Abu Timma. He's a merchant from Kardemir, and he created he used the Shi'i and Sunni religious symbols dragging trees to pray in Sunni mosque and vice versa. And he is the father of Iraqi patriotism that became the creed of the state itself and replaced the religious discourse. Now the Americans, 8 years on, rebuilt Iraq as a nation state, but on the basis of a Shia Kurdish alliance. And as in the past, the Kurds were neglected, and which created a lot of problems. We had so many rebellions in the Kurdish area, and the so-called, as Churchill put it, the supremacy or the power of the tyranny of air power put an end to it. Now we had a Shia Kurdish alliance, and the Sunnis were knocked out, as in the past the Kurds were knocked out. So there is no equilibrium. But I hate to use this jargon, like Sunnis, Shiis, Kurds, but this is the reality. Now, as before we had a monopoly of power by a single party monopolized by a single tribe, and single tribe monopolized by a single family and by a Führer. It's a totalitarian system of, a very vulgar kind of patrimonial, primordial, if you like, you can add to it. Now, we have the concept of majoritarian rule. Demography is democracy. This is, of course, paradoxical and superficial understanding of what democracy is. Because Shiis or Sunnis or Kurds are not monolithic entities. Shiis and Sunnis, they have lower classes, they have peasants, they have landlords, they have modern intellectuals, middle class intellectuals, they have upper classes of industrialists, and so on and so forth. And they have all sort of ideological friends, liberals, Arabists, socialists, communists, and of course sectarian. So there is a pluralism in every single community, if you like. That's why I hate this communal language.
Let me just ask you, you've mentioned, of course, Sunnis and Shias, and the tragedy that has afflicted each and every community. In that, many would point to the 500,000 Christians that left Iraq. Was that inevitable? How could that have been stopped?
It could have been prevented, but the problem is, as I said, under dictatorship, you have strong states. They are strong in terms of oppression, but they are not strong in terms of winning civil society cooperation and support. That's why once they are removed, you'll see void everywhere. There's no society that's really, we don't have civil associations because they were hollowed out. That's why people, revert to tribal, familial kind of connections, just for by way of protection. As Khalid put it, individuals don't face state barehanded. They have institutions in the middle. We have courts of law, we have media, we have lobbies, we have pressure groups, we have all sorts of, organizations around us. Otherwise, we'd be like naked among the wolves. It's impossible to imagine, individuals facing the state barehanded. You must have something, some social force, whatever that means or is. Now, in Iraq, Christians, it's a tragedy, really. Christians formed like 4% of Iraq's population, and now they are even less than 1. And under the monarchy, we had inherited the best thing of the Ottoman era, that's the millet system, meaning that every single religious community has its own laws of marriage, of wars, of inheritance, etc., and they could elect their own representatives. And the Ottoman administration couldn't even arrest a single individual unless via the representatives of that community. And in that sense, they were rulers of their own community, but tapped into the central. And under the monarchy, we had 2% of the parliament, seats of the parliament, reserved for the Christians. They were called Nazarites, Nasara. And 2 for the Jews. They were called Musaviyin, the Musavites, followers of Prophet Musa, rather than, so they never used the Jews or Christians, they used these terms. And this continued on and on, until it was, you know, abolished one way or another, and there we are.
Thank you. Dina, so let's just think a little bit how we meet these challenges, sort of going forward, and let's talk about, in the Egyptian context, one suggestion from the past, maybe it's not a suggestion today, but certainly one historical example is the millet system, and one of giving institutionalized, guaranteed quota rights through, in terms of seats and representation. In Egypt, of course, we are now moving through sort of a democratic transition, and it seems as if majoritarianism is what is the overriding sentiment. What is the way here in the Egyptian context of guaranteeing both the rights of the majority, whatever that is, and as well as the groups that you just mentioned?
I'm not sure I agree with Dr. Falah in terms of going back to the millet system. I'm against all kinds of reversion back to something in the past. Let's move forward and let's try to build or construct a civil society and a constitution based on a civil society in which people start thinking of each other, or citizens start thinking of each other collectively beyond all these particular sectarian affiliations, religious affiliations, ethnic affiliations, cultural affiliations. So I agree with what you said, Khaled, earlier about this dichotomization of minority versus majority. But the problem is, this is how the state thinks of these groups and therefore denies their rights based on that, and therefore we have to essentially try to bring back the rights and maybe remove this kind of divisive nature or way of thinking in our societies, in our Arab societies, where we are always thinking in this very divisive manner.
Can I just stop you,
yes,
for a second? Don't some of the minority societies divide themselves?
No, I think...
And define themselves?
No, I think they are identified first as the state. Or what happens is there becomes something existential. Well, the state is defining me as that. The state is excluding me because of my religious affiliation, my sectarian affiliation, and therefore I need to defend myself now with all means sometimes, maybe taking up arms. And that creates a culture of violence, a culture of always... I mean, this culture of divisiveness is very dangerous, and this makes me very uncomfortable with going back to a millet system. And the millet system does not grant any civil rights. There's no, like, civil court. Well, we have 17 sectarian groups in Lebanon. What does that do? We don't even have a code for civil marriage. Women can't pass on their citizenship or nationality to their children. How protective is that system, which is kind of similar to this millet system? Yes, each one of them has their own courts, their religious courts, in terms of family, marriage, inheritance, divorce, etc. But what has that led us to think of ourselves? Do we identify as a nation in Lebanon, or do we identify in terms of our own sects? So that is very troubling. And I think we need to shift to something civil, something that will be more inclusive. So the Islamist state doesn't work. The dictatorship states or dictatorship-style state does not work. It's one really built from the bottom up. And the only way to do it is to be tolerant, is to promote some kind of tolerance or tolerant ideology.
Can I stop you for a second?
That doesn't put anyone under threat.
Fine.
Or make them feel under threat.
No, thank you. And you're provoking me to ask another question, which is, is the Arab world ready for something civil? Aren't identities based on religious and other core elements, you know, here for time immemorial?
The trouble I have, Salman, is with the word ready. I mean, again, ready is politicized. Sometimes the state makes us feel ready or not ready. It imposes on us this ideology when you're not ready for it. It's just like when the West says, when it looked at the Arab transitions going on in the past 2 years, the Arab region is not ready for democracy. How can it, I mean, we're all human beings, so we all have, in essence, this need or demand to be living in a society that allows us our individual rights and freedoms and to have mutual respect and tolerance for each other. So the state is also responsible for promoting that kind of tolerance and that kind of discourse of tolerance rather than acquiescing to extremist ideologies. Be they Islamist, be they Christian, it does not matter. Acquiescing and that complicity in order to maybe win votes, in order to win support from some segments in the society is what is very dangerous and troubling. Yes, it can be changed. Yes, the societies can be ready for change if that civil society is allowed to manifest itself in many forms.
Thank you. Well, Khaled, the elephant in the room here in the last couple of years is the rise of political Islam. In the context and, you know, whether it's the Ikhwan in Egypt or Nahda in Tunisia or elsewhere, they are now responsible for the democratic transitions in leading in that particular aspect. Is this going to help us clarify and the challenge that we have and seek solutions?
Yeah, well, this is, of course, as you said, maybe the fattest elephant in the room, not only the elephant in the room. But before coming to this, let me just quickly on the issue of readiness of Arab society to democracy. This has been one of the boldest arguments of all authoritarian regimes in the region. That is, you know, Arab societies are simply not ready for democracy and freedom. So let's just kind of pass on it. And my answer to this, I think any quick answer to this, yes, we are ready, or no, we are not ready, somehow kind of hasty reaction. I guess my humble take on this, yes, we are not ready, but we have to do it. Because we have waited long enough, we have given the chance to these states, to these regimes, again, more than 6 or 7 decades, to prepare us for democracy, and they did nothing. I mean, if they did the South, the model of South Korea, or I don't know, Thailand, Malaysia, yes, you have an authoritarian regime, but at the same time, they're building the country, they're building viable economy, they're enhancing the middle class. You have kind of some sort of dynamics that is really preparing the society and the nation for this hopeful and coming democracy. In this case, we would have given you even more chance. But again, over the past 6 or 7 decades, we just lost them without anything. Yes, we are not ready, but we have to go through or down this track despite our unreadiness. Now, coming back to the whole issue of political Islam and rise of Islamism in relation of minorities and sectarianism, we have so many kind of, I guess, entry points and where we can start from. One big point is to do with, again, constitutional citizenship that we have started with in relation to nation state building. And to try to scrutinize and understand how the Islamists in their different shades understand the whole notion of citizenship and democracy. And if we kind of dig deep, and I used to be kind of maybe apologetic of the democratic kind of approach of the mainstream Islamist parties. But I have to confess that I am deeply disappointed of what we have been witnessing over the past 2 years. That defies even maybe the common sense, the logic. First of all, we have witnessed sheer and deep misunderstanding of the notion of democracy. You have this obsession amongst the mainstream Islamist parties, now let alone the radical ones, that is, democracy is based on the rule of the majority. So this obsession of parliamentarian majority, and once we got there, once we won 51% of the votes and seats in parliament, then we have the power. The people enabled us to do whatever we like. Now this is a huge misconception in the whole notion of democracy. And I think the last battle in Egypt was the whole battle on the so-called entrenched principles where you have this debate even before drawing the constitution, saying, listen, guys, there are some principles that they even go pre the constitution. And it is kind of out of logic. It's unconstitutional to draw a constitution based on the majority in the parliament, because you have values and you have principles, especially to do with the equality of citizens, regardless of their religion, ethnicity, and this and that. And then you move on to the constitution, you move on to the parliament, and this and that. The democratic process is meant, yes, to give the majority the right, of course, to rule the country, but at the same time to protect the minorities. It is an equal bird with two wings. If you just fly with one wing, that is, you know, the rule of the majority. This is the dictatorship of the majority. Even if you win the elections by 99%, this doesn't mean you have the power maybe to ethnically cleanse the remaining 1%. Logically speaking, mathematically speaking, this means, well, yes, you have the power. But this is not the way that democracy is based. So this is one big thing. Another alarming, in fact, even maybe more than alarming, direction that we have been witnessing, especially in Egypt, this kind of tacit replication of the Iranian model without acknowledgement. They would say, no, I mean, we hate this, we are not kind of following the Iranian model. But in fact, the de facto practice is almost very close to that, especially in having clauses in the constitution saying we give the authority and power to Al-Azhar institution, which is a religious institution, to approve of every single legislation taken by the parliament. And in this case, in my view, the whole process is simply void and meaningless. If you, after all these kind of elections and democracy and parliament, then you say the very final vetting system is Al-Azhar institution. In this case, this is the same council in Iran when you have the ulama standing, you know, at the gate of the parliament saying yes or no to all these laws. So this is, I think, extremely dangerous move. And just think of, I mean, the people nowadays, they think of the people in, say, in the parliament, maybe the most benign, moderate, maybe Islamists, they would think of Al-Azhar as the most moderate and centrist religious institution. So this is the institution that for centuries used to keep the equilibrium in society and even in religion. That's fine. But if you think nowadays there is a huge battle over who leads the Al-Azhar between Al-Ikhwan, the brothers, and the Salafis, well, then it's very legitimate to think that maybe 10 years down the line, maybe the Salafi movement, the Salafi trend, would even control Al-Azhar. And then, of course, in turn, they would even control the constitution, because the constitution in itself, it even mentions and names Al-Azhar in name. So Al-Azhar would have the ultimate say, the ultimate control on the constitution. And again, Al-Azhar is an open open institution for the brothers, for the Salafi movement, for At-Tahrir, the Liberation Party, anything. So this is very, very tricky and very moving sand, I think. Again, very alarming. And in the constitution itself, once you have stipulated, say, the Sharia law is the main, and maybe even the ultimate source of legislation, this is without any kind of diplomatic maybe talk. This means any non-Muslim is second-class citizen, period. Now, we can justify, we can have interpretations, we can go around all these kind of things, but, well, in a nutshell, this is what it means. And we have to face it. Declare it then. This is a religious state. In Egypt, we want a religious state based on Islam, and every non-Muslim
on that, let me challenge you for just a second. Sharia, many would say, actually guarantees minority rights. It is something which has proven over the centuries that it actually does do that. What is your answer to that?
Well, yes, it does. It does, but again, in the Islamic and religious sense, in the hierarchy of religious affiliation, in the notion of tolerance, all religions they are fond of the notion of tolerance. This is a very old notion. It's old fashioned now. The modern notion is coexistence. If I am tolerant vis-a-vis you, It means, it implicitly means, I am much better than you. But I am, because I am good enough, I am tolerant than you. So if my ideology is X, and I am noble enough to say, well, I am tolerant towards your ideology, again, there is an embedded assumption that is my ideology is superior. So I think we have to move from the notion of tolerance to the notion of coexistence. We are all equals. Nobody is better than other. There is no superior ideology, no superior idea in society. You as a Christian or as a Jew or as a Muslim or any, we are all equals as citizens. Nobody is tolerating the other. We all coexist with each other. Maybe we hate each other, but we don't care. Hatred is not something materialistic. It doesn't translate into laws. But with tolerance, hatred could be translated into laws and legal system.
Thank you very much. Well, I think that's a good point for us, for me to stop and to throw open the floor. I think you've heard plenty here which should elicit a response. All I ask you to do, please, is to give us your name and any affiliation. And please, if you want to make some comments, that's absolutely fine. But try to keep them as succinct as you can. And please ask a question if you can. Dr. Zachary.
Salman, please allow me to speak in Arabic because it's aired to an Arab-speaking audience. Huh?
Of course.
So, Lina.
Shukran jazilan. Thank you very much for your presentation or your intervention, which is not complete. For 6 years, we have not heard one person that supports the right of majority. 150 people have been sentenced to jail, and Egypt was faced problems in 1982 because they protect the right of minorities. So this is very problematic for us. So all what we have in Egypt have been inherited from previous eras, and what is taking place and all the violence, these are individual cases from both parts. It is not a general policy. You have not indicated in the Egyptian constitution, did not refer to the constitution that the believers of other religions, they can use their own legislations. There is no discrimination. All citizens are equal. I am a member of the revolution, and I feel really, really bad when I hear people talking about minority. And after the revolution, I would like to talk about Egyptian citizens, Christians and Muslims. Murkos is assistant to the president, and also we have many, many other members. He did not refer to these personalities. Our brothers, the Christians, they have complete freedom. They can hold and occupy any position, and this is guaranteed by the Egyptian constitution. Please do revisit the constitution. Maybe we disagree on a number of articles, but I have to tell you that the Egyptian constitution has given rights that were not guaranteed or granted by any other systems prior to that. Shukran jazilan.
Encourage you to challenge, as you have, panelists and each other as well. We'll go to the gentleman here.
Shukran, Abdillah Al-Mansouri, I'm a researcher in the Muassasa Alamiya.
I am a researcher. I have got four observations. Talking about concepts, I agree with Mr. Khalid when he said we have to be cautious in specifying a number of concepts when we talk about majority and minority. I have read an article about one of the Lebanese religious references, Muhammad al-Mahdi Shamsuddin. He was talking that in the Arab world, we have two majorities, one Islamic majority, or an Arab majority, because we all speak, most of us, we speak Arabic, an Islamic majority, because the majority religion is Islamic. So the concept of minority, even in our heritage, has not been used before. And now it was very much linked to the Millal system in the confrontation of the reformist rule of the West. And the second point, it's an observation, and the speakers did not refer to this point, which is you do not talk about the external role or the foreign role as far as the minorities are concerned. Dr. Mohammed Al-Jabri, when he Abid Al-Jabri, when he talked about our crisis in the Arab world, or when we talk about the transitional period and liberation period, liberating from the heritage, is linked and closely linked to the foreign hands. So, I mean, in the West, when they liberated themselves and they had their own transitions, there were no foreign hands that played a role. So I would like to talk about the Mashriq. In Morocco, the constitution, they give the guarantee to all minorities. And in Iraq, we have a different position altogether. I mean, some of the people in Iraq, they entered the parliament as Shiite and not because of other, political affiliations. And we should not also forget the Zionist project. Because the Zionist project decade came to unite all Jews in the world. But when they talk about Arabs, they differentiate between Muslims, non-Muslims, Druze and non-Druze. In the Grand Maghreb, they try to nationalize Al Amazigh or the Berbers. I am from North Africa. We did not have, even in the past we had, Amazigh, but we did not have this issue. So the foreign hands, the external hands are very important as a component, and their role is very important because, the external factors, they played a great role in supporting totalitarian regimes. And when we talk about building the nation state, yes, we face problems in building our nation states, and I think there is an external factor, but we have to be also objective, and we have to try to adopt a kind of a dual criticism. We have to talk about the external factors and also the internal factors. We should not forget also the secular factor internally. We're talking about a kind of a mentality, either a ruling mentality or an opposition mentality that was not able to overcome the differences and difficulties for them to be able to build and reach a kind of a nation state. So when we talked about whether we are ready or not, to be ready or not ready, I think this is a kind of an orientalistic idea. I mean, India, when they got their independence, they started straight away building their nation state. And the same thing, has to do with the Africans in North Africa. They moved and they started once they got rid and liberated themselves from racism in South Africa. They started building their own nation with the help of Nelson Mandela. I think we should not concentrate on these ideas, the ideas of minority and also the ideas of these issues that has to do with Orientalism. I have reservations when we talk about the Copts as a minority. No, they shouldn't be treated as a minority. I think that with the advent of Sadat, we have seen the changes, and the changes did not happen during the Iranian Revolution. And after that, we have seen a retreat, and now we can see the sectarian discourse coming very strongly here. Then Atharta Nikatan.
Get a couple more, sir.
Alfred Asfour from Television Qatar.
From Television of Qatar, I want to hear about the provocation we hear about. There's usually a provocation against the minorities by the regime. This is something when the authority of the state is falls down, this such a provocation is encouraged, such as we saw in Iraq, the Christians become the victims. In Egypt, the Sunnis cannot tolerate the few Shiites they have. This is only because of the general discourse. Do you have a response to this?
Do you have anyone else? Okay. Let's go through it. I think there's some very interesting questions there. We'll start with Dr. Jabbaran. Just pick and choose whichever one you want to focus on, including, I think, the foreign external element as well.
Yeah, the problem of majority and minority, it's a big problem in democratic systems. As I said, in homogeneous societies, we don't have a problem. Like all the citizens are Christians, or all of them are Muslims, all of them are Catholic, all of them are Protestant, what have you. The concept of democracy is one man, one vote, and free for all. But yet, even in the United States, it was not until the 60s that a Catholic was elected as president. It was not before the new millennium that half-caste, half-African-American, half-white, that would be elected as president. So, I mean, things move towards the concept, okay? The concept is ideal. Reality is something else. And you have a distance there. And that's what Khaled meant, that we are not ready in the sense, not because we are, have a lot of defects, but the structure of society, the culture, everything points to a slow motion towards the concept of democracy. Now, as I said, when we have a multicultural, multi-ethnic society, what do we do? Ethnic majorities will become political majorities. And ethnic minorities or religious minorities will always be political minorities. And we are talking about political minorities here. What do we do? One solution is to have federalism, which is division of power to keep the country intact. And sometimes you have this kind of federalism for big states, big countries. You can't, central government cannot control all of it. But there are also small countries that, go to the federal structure, as in India, or, in other countries, in smaller countries, they do that to resolve the problem of majority-minority, because democracy will turn into ethnocracy. That's the dictatorship and the rule of the big group. Another solution is autonomy. Like a small group in a homogeneous region will have self-rule, and the central government have the so-called central powers, defense, foreign policy, finances, etc. And then you have even small counties who can do self-regulation and self-government to protect their cultural rights. We are accustomed to the idea of the strong hero who rules the country. We are accustomed, which is a false idea. It's just an illusion. Homogeneous nation. There is no homogeneous nation in the world, from North Pole to the South Pole. All countries now are multicultural, heterogeneous in every sense of the word. There is no unified, one heart, one soul nation. This is a myth. This is the myth created by dictators. People have differences, and they will always have differences. And even you have differences within your own self. If you don't have differences, you are a dead body. I mean, you are a corpse. Only corpses don't have arguments and differences and this and that. And yes, we live in a world that the whole world interacts with each other. the West impact on us. We impact on the West. I mean, look at London. Look, we have bombers there. And, you know, the whole world is interacting. And we shouldn't absolve ourselves of our responsibilities. We have profound responsibilities of what's going on. Okay? I hear all the time, I hear, well, this happened because, you know, the Americans did that, or the British did that. Why they could do this at this very moment? Why they couldn't do it before? Why they couldn't before, you know, 50 years ago or 100 years ago? There's always something inside. There's always something native. And we are looking at the native. It's a good thing to start with criticizing yourself rather than, and then you go to criticizing the others. Because it requires a lot of courage, a lot of bravery to look at your own defects, okay? And see, I always train my students to see the good points in your enemy and the bad points in you, so that you can reassess the bad points in your enemy and the good points in you. It could be more balanced. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Khaled.
If you allow me, I want to check if it's pick and choose.
Yes.
Alfred's...
But I may come back. I reserve the right to still ask you, to press you on.
Authoritarianism, you see?
But pick and choose.
Embedded everywhere. Well, it's about the media thing, which is, I think, very fascinating and extremely crucial at this point, especially in relation with sectarianism and minorities. If you think of it, if we're talking about media, zoom out... there is some sort of kind of imbalance of freedoms, relatively speaking, nowadays in the Arab region, especially in the Arab Spring or post-Arab Spring countries, where you have free media now, and yet you don't have free thinking. Now, because of this, the free media now is somehow suppressing the free thinking. So we have this kind of huge paradox. Even in the media, if you like, in the media kind of studies and media jargon, there is this instrumental notion, which is the public sphere. Public sphere means, put by a German scholar, Habermas, meaning you have the authority, you have the state on the top, then you have the public, you have the people, everyone. And then in the blood, in the genes of every single state, they would love to control every single pocket aspect of society. So you have the authority, it comes, you know, top down. Then you have the notion of civil society. You know, the public will try to drive back the authority of the state. And the public sphere is the sphere that is kind of created in between to protect, you know, the public, the people, from the transgressions of the state. And then the smaller the state, the wider and the bigger the public sphere is, and the freer the society would be. Now, what we ended up, and of course, it's a very thriving, supposedly, sphere, where you have the civil society organizations, media, groups, all the lobbies, all these kind of, you know, groups and even single issue, maybe parties, would be there, again, defending their issues. Now, what we have ended up with in the Arab countries, in the post-Arab Spring countries, yes, we have driven back the state. We have created this sphere, the public sphere, and then against the authoritarianism of the state, of course. And guess what? Who steps in is religious authoritarianism through religious media. So we have horizontal authority, not kind of vertical one, occupying what has been liberated by the Arab Spring. So we have now this kind of, again, ended up with this very paradoxical setting, even defying and challenging maybe all media studies. And because you have this, again, free media, and people would say, well, that's great. This would lead to free thinking, you know, ideas and things. And now it's kind of backtracking. So people now, when they compare even the situation of media freedoms before and after the Arab Spring, they would end up with this kind of bleak scenario. Again, because of this media thing. Now, what kind, if we, again, zoom in now into this media, we will find so many kind of devastating kind of, I think, processes. One of them, not only Muslim-Christian kind of, you know, antagonism and this and that, which does exist, of course, but go beyond this to the Sunni Shia thing. Now, this media, religious media, especially religious broadcasting media, the TV media, these preachers on the TV, be they Muslims or Christians, Sunni or Shia, the same thing, you know, you just change the words and it's the same outcome. Now, they would go back in history and they would bring in all these very old historical battles from 14 centuries ago and reproduce them, recycles them in the present day jargon. And not only this, these battles, they have been limited to the debate within the narrow circles of scholars and ulama, the theology, the differences between Sunnis and Shias, when you dig deep down and you are surprised. These were limited in this yellow box. Nobody would even reach them. Now they are publicized because of the media. So now this is now you have people, I am Sunni Muslim, I am Shia Muslim, and Aisha said this and Hussein said that. All these battles, nobody even knew about them. Again, because of the media. Your question, I think, is very crucial. I have no answer. I'm just kind of furthering the bitterness behind maybe the question. But it's very challenging, I think, issue. And the media, one of maybe the solutions that Salman was saying on how can we challenge this, I think one of the biggest areas is the media.
Right. The role of foreign hands?
Well, I think Abdelilah is partly correct. However, it was more so in the past. If we think of the colonial era, during the Ottoman, European kind of wars, all these, as our friend here mentioned, all these huge interventions, they took place in the name of protecting minorities. But this is one thing should be acknowledged, and we have to link this and make it clear. But at the same time, presently, at the current time, I think this dimension has been kind of receding, and we have to look into ourselves more. And if you think of Egypt, what kind of external intervention, if you look into, I don't know, Syria, Iraq, I mean, you think of, it is there maybe, but I guess more weight as on our side, on the side of, say, self-criticism and inward looking to find what went wrong, if we could.
Thank you. It just occurred to me everything you just said on the media has been broadcast live to an audience not just here, but across the Arab world.
I'll be banned from all these.
No, which is a good thing. Which is a good thing.
They will punish you.
Lena, of course, I'd like you to answer with regards to the specific comments made on Egypt, as well as anything else you'd like to take.
Yes. Well, we have limited time. Thank you for all your questions. I wish I could address all of them, but please wait for my policy paper, which will come out from Brookings soon, which will obviously go into much more detail. And it's all based on my field research in Egypt. I just want to touch on two points, the constitution and to what extent it is inclusive and to what extent it is exclusive in Egypt. Many in civil society feel that it excludes them, and this is the group that represents liberals, socialists, leftists, youth, for instance, religious minorities, women. Secularists feel that it excludes them. Why do they feel that? They go to specific articles, for instance. Article 2 that talks about the Sharia as a source which characterizes the nation as Muslim and Arab is not really contentious. That has been there, and it is part of constitutions in many other Arab countries. The contentious article, or the one that is contested, is Article 219, which allows or enables the state to implement a specific Sunni fuqh, to implement it in legislation and so forth. And this is what scares the majority, not only religious minorities, but the majority of civil society, as I found during my field research. In terms of women, for instance, the article on gender equality that was there in the 1971 Constitution, Article 68, was actually removed. And in terms of women, the one article that stresses them is the one that stresses family, their role in family, and stresses culture and tradition. So there's a cultural relativistic perspective that is being the emphasis of the new constitution over, say, human rights and gender equality in general. Also, Article 43 recognizes only the three faith traditions, the Abrahamic faith traditions, Islam, Christianity, and Judaism. It doesn't leave any room for Baha'is, for instance, to be included. The ID, the National Identification Card, only recognizes, again, these three Abrahamic faith traditions. Baha'is, who I talk to, have certainly a problem with that because they feel completely excluded and completely invisible in Egyptian society. And there may be others. So there's a lot I could go on and on about the Constitution, which makes members of civil society feel excluded, and that the Constitution in general was rushed. And though there was a referendum, it only represented about 50% of those eligible to vote on it. And the rest of the 50% feel that they have been excluded from it. So that is the problematic. And this big tension and battle that is going on in Egyptian society nowadays that actually prevents, it's reached a stalemate, and it prevents them to move forward in this transitional phase. The other issue that I wanted to point out is to address this question of generally the sectarian violence. I didn't have time to touch on this, but I wanted to identify at least three factors that cause this. It's not really individuals, just not an individual that essentially starts all this violence that happens. And I can and go on into the incidents of sectarian violence. There are just so many of them. They're not only Muslim-Christian, but there's other incidents as, you know, recently with what happened in Abu Musallam. But this has been going on since the 1990s. And I've looked into so many incidents of sectarian violence, and I've sort of like boiled it down to three main factors for why this happens. One is political. In many of these rural areas, in the Sa'id, where the Copts represent approximately anything between 30 to 50% of the local population, what happens is they represent a voting bloc. So this voting bloc becomes very influential in terms of elections, local elections there, which causes some kind of political competitiveness. This is my reading from how some of these incidents started. This is one. Then the number two factor that I notice is economic competitiveness between Muslims and Christians, which may lead to some form of sectarian conflicts and violence. In some cases, it leads to a large number of kidnappings, which is now rampant because of the security vacuum in the country. Not only adults are being kidnapped for ransom, but also little children. And I've met with children who have been tortured, tied with ropes, and so forth, to get a substantial sum of money from. And this is not just targeting Christians, but they are one of the vulnerable groups there. So, and because they are seen to probably have or be willing to pay that sum of money, they are targeted in a sense. So there's the political, there's the economic, and there's the social religious. The social religious includes fear, say, of the Christian community of losing members. So, for instance, over the years, there's been a lot of conversions, especially of Coptic fathers to Islam. Now, the church doesn't like losing numbers, so does the mosque. It doesn't like losing numbers, but when the church feels like it's losing numbers, it wants to reconvert those into Christianity, and that creates a lot of heated tensions in specific rural areas, especially where these incidents have happened. What that creates is a social problem where the children and the mother that are abandoned usually don't have like financial support, and it's creating all kinds of other problems that I don't have time to go through. But I realized that the children themselves are called Coptic orphans, even though their fathers had not died, but they are called Coptic orphans because it, you know, there's a sense of abandonment and lack of support from them. And that creates a lot of tensions. So for me, I can break it down into these three as main problems for sectarian violence, and I'll be happy to go into more depth and detail with you individually. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Lena. You've trailed very well your policy paper, which... should be out in a on a website or in a another place pretty soon. Let me also say thank you to you, Lena, because you've been a great joint fellow. We've been very proud to have you, and I'm sure Qatar University has been very proud to have you as well. I can't do justice to this very rich discussion, I know, but I will attempt just a few points by way of summary, because I think it's been such a rich discussion, it'd be good just to regurgitate perhaps and emphasize some of them. I think the first point is made, we have to be careful about terminology, and I think that's been made here as well as from the floor when we talk about majorities and minorities. We've talked a lot about the failure of the building of nation states, the abuse of power in that respect, and the existential fears that that has raised, particularly among certain communities. As has been stressed, all societies are multicultural, heterogeneous, and that people have differences, and that the challenge here is how to manage these differences. I think one thing that we've heard here, and I think is very, very important, is the importance of building viable, truly democratic states and societies. And it's not just about majority rule. It is about trying to find systems where you can have the protection of minorities as well as other majority communities, a bird with two wings, as you described it, Khalid. And in terms of moving forward, I think it's very, very interesting, important points you raise about the building up of civil society, but most crucially about citizenship and the concept of citizenship and what that means in the modern Arab nation state and in the modern notions of coexistence that come from it. And then we can talk further about systems of governance, federal structures, devolution to the regions, and the important role of media in that particular respect. And I think your points about a deterministic media, the horizontal thing, is very well taken. Anyway, I'm sure I haven't done it justice, but I found it thoroughly enriching. Thank you very much for joining us. Let us all thank Dr. Lena Beydoun, Dr. Khaled Roub, and Dr. Falah Shabar. Thank you very much. I'm sure we'd like to say thank you to them. There are refreshments outside as well, but before that, let's give them a round of applause.